Hello and welcome to this episode of The Broadcast. I'm your host, David Brooks, Head of Policy here at Broadstone. And I'm joined by two colleagues of mine to talk through how 2024 was for them from an actuarial and risk transfer perspective on what we're looking forward to in 2025. So I'm joined by David Hamilton, who is our Chief Actuary, and Chris Rice, who's Head of Trustee Services. Welcome along to the podcast, guys.
Hi there.
Hi there.
So, David, I'm going to turn to you first. Really nice open question for you, just to give us your feelings of the big topics over 2024 and some of the bigger events and how they impacted scheme funding conversations.
Well, I don't think you can go too far into the big events for 2024 without starting with the funding code. I'm sure we'll circle around to it a few times, but so many years in the making, we finally got our hands on the final version. Ended up in Parliament with a little disruption from the election. So it ended up in Parliament at the end of July and was effective for valuations from the 22nd of September last year. So we're now in a brave new world where we're operating under the new funding code and the associated funding regulations. And there's a little Christmas present towards the end of the year. We even got the long-awaited revised covenant guidance from the regulator as well. So another big piece of the puzzle in terms of their rethink as to how employers' covenants need to be assessed by trustees. A big shift there, really, from their old kind of light touch, oh, you're in one of four buckets, so, you know, strong, tending to weak or weak, to actually needing some much more granular information and people really sort of diving into the figures on that. So some interesting stuff there that I'm sure will raise its ugly head through the years ahead. In wider news, I guess we had the Section 37 appeal. So we'd had the ruling on the Virgin Media case the previous year, but in the summer we did get the appeal, which just said, yep, the judge was completely right. We agree with everything they said. So confirmed all of that. Again, that's still, you know, in terms of actions, I know we're going to come into what's up this year, but I think that one's going to run and run for a bit longer. But that was a big event in 2024 for us. And then looking a bit more widely, we've seen the growth of Clara, our consolidator, doing its first transaction back at the end of the 2023. It's added a couple more now, so it's now got more than 20,000 members in there. Big Debenhams case that we were heavily involved in, so that was a big one, particularly for us. And then finally, we've had government consultations on this, that and the other. The previous government were making lots of noise about use of surplus, which then went very, very quiet for a long time, but has then popped into the news more recently. So again, more things change, the more they stay the same, I guess. But yeah.
Yeah, it was quite a year. I'll come on to some of the other areas just when we look at 2025, what we think, because I think, as you say, some of those topics from last year are going to continue through into this year. So we'll come back on those in a second. Chris, so David touched a little bit on sort of the risk transfer conversation. I know that's a major part of your thinking, given your role and looking after our proposition there, the Smart Insure proposition. So from a risk transfer perspective, how was your 2024?
Yeah, I think I was going to start by talking about the difference between two chancellors, just to try and introduce some controversy into the discussion and take it away from pensions, but let's stick with what I know about. But I think the issue really is probably comparing the two different Mansion House speeches. Mm-hmm. I think when we were in the position towards the end of 2023, there was a real concern from the Chancellor at the time about small schemes, the small schemes holding back businesses, the small schemes being able to club together and invest productively and to reduce their risk and risk transfer if they needed to, and that being really difficult. To 2024, by the time we got to the first Mansion House speech for Rachel Reeves, being the case that the market had really freed up during the year for small schemes, and that being a very different position. I think that's probably the biggest headline of the year from the risk transfer perspective, is that the insurance market has wisened up to the fact that small schemes are good to do business with. They you know, come on to a lot of reasons for that. I've known it for all the time that we've been doing risk transfer for small schemes, but you know, they are there's good money to be made there, insurers can see. There is less competition for their business. They've got good brokers like Broadstone. They are very well prepared. And increasingly, insurers and the consultancies like us that work with them are very used to working with them and making the deals much more streamlined, which is something I'm sure we'll come on to later.
That's interesting. You're touching on sort of the smaller scheme angle. So if we can move on to what you think, how 2025 is going to look. So stay with you, Chris, just for a second. So would you envisage smaller schemes having a bit more interest and actually making over the line and getting those deals done when the rhetoric, I mean, there was a lot of chat in the press, especially about small schemes throughout 23 and into early 24. But if you were a trustee of a smaller pension scheme previously, perhaps I think I might describe them as ugly ducklings, but that was not in a purely pejorative sense, it's more of a metaphorical sense, but now they might have just turned into the swans we all knew they were.
Yeah, I do feel that there, certainly at the end of 2023, there was that view that this is already difficult and the surge in demand is only going to see it get more difficult as more schemes approach insurers. Possibly the discussions at that time of the release valve of the government consolidator made the commercial market get itself together and start serving these small schemes. But I think so. I don't think there will be a sea change because, as we've often said on the insurers and the capacity, the issue is human resource, and that can only expand gradually. So I would expect steady growth as insurers who previously have been looking at larger deals start to become interested in smaller deals, steady growth as those established insurers in that market build their capacity and become more efficient, and as new entrants come in and enter that space as well.
I was going to ask about the new players, how are they settling in? Do we know much of how many deals they've done and how they're getting on with getting up to speed?
Yeah, they're not yet quoting and transacting at volume, but as you know, both Royal London and Utmost recently have done publicised deals at below 100 million and would expect Royal London to be looking at double figures for numbers of deals in the year and Utmost similarly. But as they get their systems embedded and their teams recruited and trained up, then no doubt they'll be looking to recoup on that investment and be doing more deals.
Mm. Okay, David, if we switch back to you and your thinking ahead to 2025, have you got a different list for what might be ahead for 2025, or is it similar to 2024?
a lot of it is similar. A lot of pensions doesn't move that fast, Dave. You know that by now.
That's a long term game. I didn't mean to sound quite so accusatory when I was asking that question. Have you got something new for me, David? No, it was very much sort of, you know, if it's still going to be the similar themes going through into 2025.
Absolutely. I mean, whilst we had the funding code hit us, you know, really it only has any meaning to schemes when they come to do their valuation. So for a large number of schemes, they'll be doing their valuation over the next year or so. And that's where it will really hit home, I think, some of the new elements of the new funding code. I think even those who aren't doing evaluation this year, there's probably stuff in there that they'll want to start thinking about. There's a lot more strategic planning involved now. It's not just kind of I'll get the actuary to run a set of numbers and on you go. They need to kind of commit to their long-term destination, how they're going to get there, what their journey plan is, all that sort of thing. And having those conversations with the employer in advance and trying to get some of those communications going, I think, rather than leaving it all to the wait until the valuation date happens, I think that will be a big advantage to them. As for other things, yeah, I mean, Section 37 continues to rumble around, and we see differing views on that between different sets of trustees, between different sets of lawyers, and different levels of interest from company auditors as well. So certainly the year end, we've had some challenging questions from company auditors about what trustees are doing on that front. And I think it's potentially slightly different for those trustees who think they're going to be running their scheme for many years, and those who are perhaps trying to start a conversation with Chris and the smart team about buyout and actually, well, are you sure you really know what benefits you want to buy out?
Mm. Yeah, so I'll get both your thoughts on Section 37 as we've just sort of paused here. So for David, your perspective, I'm going to ask you sort of more from an ongoing scheme. What's the general consensus, do you think, to deal with it? Is it, well, let's have a look, at least we know, or is it let's just, unless we need to look, let's just leave it, let's leave it be?
I think to suggest there was any general consensus would probably make me look foolish, but there's definitely a variety of views. From my perspective, I'd encourage trustees to be making an active decision about it. You know, deciding not to look is very different to, oh, I don't want to think about this too now, just now, yeah. It's too hard. Mm. So, you know, there's very few schemes that we're finding that have got a completely clean bill of health that can actually say, look, here's all the deeds I've done and here's all the certificates that go with them, and therefore there's absolutely nothing to worry about here. Equally, there's very few schemes that genuinely believe they've got a problem. You know, they think, oh, well, we went through proper processes at the time, surely everything was done fine. But whether we can find a piece of paper from 20 years ago is a very different proposition. So, you know, I can understand the range of different views, the lack of appetite to rush and do something. But at the same time, it's not going to get easier to find old bits of paper. And if you are trying to then make a decision at the point of going to an insurer or whatever, then perhaps it is worth trying to sort of grasp the metal, as it were, and try and resolve what you're going to do now rather than kicking it down the road too much. I mean, there is talk about, oh, there's appeals coming, there's various, you know, additional court cases, maybe the DWP will do something. My suspicion is the court cases will probably be quite scheme specific in terms of the rule wording, and so, you know, it's not likely to help the vast majority of people. And the noise about the DWP, I think there is, you know, some general slow rumblings on that front, but again, I'm not expecting anything to come very quickly, and even if it does come, it may not solve all the problems for all the schemes out there. It will probably have some specific restrictions and regulations are tied to it. So I don't think there's going to be a magic bullet on that, and actually understanding where you are and kind of having a view that you're happy with is probably a good starting point for all trustee boards to consider.
Mm. And so, Chris, given your day job, you tend to be there at the end of the line. So the scheme's got to the end and they've got this issue buzzing around. What's the, I can't say consensus again. Is there a consensus way of, you know, dealing with it and making it either end or not?
There's definitely a consensus way of starting the process, which is understand your risk. And I think pretty much all trustees and employers do want to know their level of exposure. Whether that goes right down to searching through every single deed and cabinet and doing actuarial calculations of the potential misliability, no, but they're definitely having a red, amber, green on all of their deeds and how significant they might be before entering into a bulk annuity project. And then I'd say there's three potential outcomes at that with regards to whether or not they proceed to purchase a bulk annuity. And anecdotally across the Smart Insure team, I think they're probably equally spaced, all the schemes we deal with across those three. So the first one is, it's just stupid. We know about it. It's bound to go away. It's absolute nonsense. There's a risk here, but we're going to plow on anyway. Had some of them. Or the risk is minimal and we can take it and we'll plow on anyway. So we're not too worried about it. In the middle is a good detailed look, understanding what the potential exposure is, and speaking to the employer, understanding the insurer's amendment provisions, should there need to be an amendment if it doesn't go their way, hoping it won't, crossing their fingers and proceeding. And then a third that I just said, there's too much uncertainty. We are not going to move ahead with a bulk annuity transaction at this point. The reason being the loss of control and the fact that to amend the benefits, you're at the time scale, the terms and conditions and the cost of the insurer when you come to do it. So, we've probably had a mixture of each.
Mm-hmm. OK, I think we'll park section 37 there. It is one of those topics I bring up sometimes with actuaries and lawyers, and we usually spend about an hour, and that wasn't our intention. So I will move on. So, David, I'll come back to you. I want to talk a little bit more about the funding code, and just, are there any early lessons I know it's very early days, but is there anything that's coming out that's showing itself as being a potential opportunity or a risk for trustees and sponsors?
I think we're finding it's complicated. You know, we already knew there was a lot of work. There's a lot of extra calculations involved, extra projections involved, determining when you're going to hit this significant maturity date, so the kind of the cutoff where the regulator then expects you to be in a low risk position beyond that point. But as we actually start to do the first valuations and trying to work through the, you know, the documentation of it with trustees and employers, and that's before we even get to the, you know, them signing their name on a statement of strategy, but just trying to get agreement as to, well, where are we headed realistically, you know, what is our end game, and then just the range of options, you know, within the funding code there is still a fair amount of flexibility. We're expecting a degree of herding towards the fast track measures that have been put in place by the regulator, but partly market conditions aren't perhaps that well suited to some of them in terms of corporate bond yields and where people would want to commit to being in their low risk position, and just getting the numbers to add up. I think whilst there may be an immediate appeal to head that way, when it comes to actually, well, that means you're going to have to put in X amount of contributions, suddenly the shift of the conversation is quite rapid. So there may be a bit of heading, but there's an awful lot of flexibility around that. And something like the expense loading is going to be a big one, but has quite a range of, you know, possible outcomes as to how you would define that or try and quantify what the allowance for your future expenses might be.
I'm just going to ask you about what you were talking about then about the assumptions. So I suppose it's that mindset change. You had technical provisions as being the measure, and now we've got this long-term objective, which is becoming, you know, which will be the measure, or will have to be when you get to that relevant date. Are you seeing quite a big shift then? So one of the points I'm trying to get to in the question is there's so much in the press around surpluses, you know, but then the ONS stats, PPF stats, TPR stats, and then somebody else's stats, and, you know, whoever, you know, all these different measures we have out there, all every consultancy seems to have their own index or measurement. We've got one, but anyway, but everyone's got one, but they all seem to come out with, ours is slightly different, ours is unique, but anyway, they all seem to come out with broadly different answers. And so is the situation on the ground, you know, with you guys actually, and Chris can come in on this as well, but you guys actually advising real clients is that, okay, it's all well and good, you might have a surplus on a technical provisions basis, but when you actually look at this long-term objective, it isn't probably quite as rosy as you may have thought. I mean, I'm not saying things are a disaster and there's deficits everywhere that are huge and unsustainable, but it's that rhetoric that kind of the conversation seems to run away with itself sometimes. But the reality, through the code, this is a very long question, through the code, you know, and everything else, means that actually trustees and sponsors are actually not sitting on a huge surplus after all. They're sitting on something, you know, a bit different.
Yeah, I think there was a question somewhere in there, wasn't
there? Sorry. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Lifetime lies of statistics, isn't it? I mean, you could probably create a fictional number about the surplus to suit any argument you want to push, and certainly certain individuals have been doing so to suit their particular arguments. I think the dates that you're gathering the information as well, you know, often people are relying on stuff from 18 months ago, 2 years ago, or trying to kind of merge a whole set of different figures from different dates. So you do get a different range of views depending on the purpose that they're being used for and where the numbers have come from. You know, most schemes are in a much better place than they were in 5-10 years ago. It's no question about that. Yeah. And a lot of schemes are heading in the right direction and consistent with the funding code. So we're not necessarily seeing a huge shift in people having to completely rethink how they're approaching things. But there are some differences of schemes that thought they were, you know, there or nearly there. And actually, once you refine it to say, actually, you've got to take that bit less risk once you're beyond maturity, you've got to allow for what the expenses might be over that long term horizon, then it is causing people to rethink some of those numbers and perhaps not be quite as well off as they thought they were. I think also the extra work on the employer covenant and really focusing on, you know, can you really bank on this employer being here with, you know, more than enough money to support you indefinitely? Well, actually, no, you need to get yourself into a position where you don't think you're going to need them for any money whatsoever. That's quite a different proposition. And so there is a kind of a moving of the goalposts and stretching of schemes to push that little bit further to be, you know, I guess, capitalise on the good work that's already been done, but push them that bit further towards true self-sufficiency.
Yeah, I think if I've got nothing to add to that on the basis of what the general funding level is, because it's self-selecting, I tend to see schemes that are quite well funded and looking towards buyout. So To comment about the universe of all schemes would be a little bit biased, I think. But the schemes that I'm seeing are a mixture of those that are fully funded or healthy surplus on buyout, and some that have still got a way to go, but the employer is prepared to put their hand in their pocket and relieve themselves of the ongoing governance and risk.
Okay. I just want to move on to something else that's sort of troubling me, and well, I've got two actuaries, I can ask them about this. Can I use the word gilt volatility in a meaningful way? Because it seems to just be all over the place at the moment. So we did a very quick paper on sort of when the gilt yields rose earlier on this year, but they seem to have come back down again. I don't know what this means for trustee planning and trustee risk. I don't know, David, if you want to come in on that. Is it volatility, or is it just what we've been spoiled for years and this is what it's always like? I don't really know.
I better say that I'm not an investment advisor, so I'm not going to pretend to be a complete expert on this. I think, you know, we are seeing volatility. I think the reason it's coming to the fore much more is all the hedging that's now in place. And in some ways, that means it doesn't matter. You've got schemes that are hedging their interest rate risk. Then, you know, gilt volatility shouldn't matter. Their assets and liabilities should be both going up and down, and therefore it doesn't really matter to their funding position. But we do get these shocks to the system, these additional liabilities coming in. You know, nobody's reserved for GMP equalization, nobody reserved for Section 37 costs, nobody put in their full expense reserve. And so those are suddenly new costs that you're adding in, where actually the exposure to future interest rates matters, and the volatility around gilt yields then does make a difference. And I'm sure Chris will see that, you know, for those schemes that do have a buyout deficit, volatility in the gilt market, you know, will affect how much the employer's asked to reach into their pocket to fund for extras. So, you know, there are elements that are sensitive to it. I think the other thing is that perhaps in the past, even if they did move around a bit, I don't think they were as volatile historically. I'm sure an investment expert would be able to quote figures at you. But I think it is a bit more volatile in terms of kind of the size of some of the daily movements. And again, those, you know, who were burnt by the Liz Truss scenario will immediately be nervous of underreacting to a movement in gilt yields. But also, you know, schemes aren't invested as much in growth as they were before. You know, before there was an element of, well, gilt yields are moving around a bit, but perhaps the equity market's gone up or down 10%, and that dominates what's going on with the funding. Whereas as we get more and more hedged, more and more into low risk positions, you end up focusing more and more on the kind of the smaller items, because a lot of the larger items of risk and the larger bits of volatility have moved away. And suddenly that does make us focus much more on some of these other elements.
And Christy, does it impact your processes when you're getting to do a deal? I've got no idea, to be honest. How responsive are the insurers and what their feelings are?
Yeah, when you're selling all your assets on one particular day, the cash you get in the bank account at the end is quite important. And yeah, we've had some deals that have been going on across December and January, and guaranteed quotes coming in. And the work that the investment consultants have done in conjunction with me and the insurers and price locks and things has meant that it hasn't been a worry. You never really know until you see the pounds of pence at the end. But the hedging works, the matching the price lock and making sure you're selling the assets and buying your bulk annuity on all the same day, and all the things that you worry about that have a low percentage chance of happening, but making sure you cover all your risk in moving money around did become important and did work and were all in place, which was good.
Great. Okay, so David, I come to you. Just what else will trustees and employers be thinking about from an actuarial perspective through this year?
Well, one of the stories that caught my eye recently was the PPF levy. You know, it's a topic that had been grating with some of us for a while. But, you know, the PPF was sat there saying they're in a very healthy surplus. And yet, because of the rules around how the levy works, we're still feeling the need to charge 100 million of levies to schemes every year and potentially, you know, ad infinitum, which didn't feel right. Thankfully, they've recently got enough positive noises from the DWP about rewriting those rules to allow them the flexibility to increase levies if there was a problem in future, that it means that they're going to be able to allow the the PPF levies to come down. I know a lot of our schemes are already in a kind of a good place, but when they were talking about maintaining 100 million return of levy, they were basically going to be moving out all their measures and, you know, trying to capture more schemes to stop it falling on a ever reducing number of schemes in terms of the levy. So the chance that schemes who'd done the right thing, reduced all their risk, were suddenly still going to be caught with a PPF levy just because they felt they need to get that total in to comply with their rules. So great relief that that's coming out. You know, it's down to 45 million they reckon now this year, and potentially even zero if they manage to get enough progress with the DWP and change of regulations. So I think that's great news. I think once all that's sorted, there will inevitably be some attention to what's the PPF going to do with its surplus that's already there. I know different people have different theories, and you know, there's discussions about use of surplus in general, but you know, the productive finance argument, you know, should the PPF be investing more in that? Should it be returning levies that it charged that it didn't need to schemes? And if so, you know, it's no good waiting 40 years and then trying to do that. You need to do it while the schemes are still around and it's of some benefit to them. Return it to the, you know, sponsors potentially to invest and help the economy to grow rather than it sitting tied up. So I think there is some interesting discussions there. You know, should it go into the public purse in some way? Maybe if, you know, if there's a going to be underwritten by the government in future, maybe they'd then have an argument to claim some of that, or use some of that surplus or control some of that surplus. So there's a lot of interesting discussions to be had on that. And I think once the kind of the levy element is dealt with, then it would be a natural thing to move on to some of those sort of discussions.
The other discussion for that is pre-97 pension increases as well. That would be particularly messy, I'd have thought, for quite absolutely. A few reasons.
But yeah, I mean, there's talk about member benefits and should the PPF, you know, give full benefits or that sort of thing. But, you know, one of the key elements of that model originally was that it was a standardised set of benefits. And the more you move away from that, the more it complicates the issue and again, brings into question how have all these levies been calculated thus far? Because if you've paid in, you know, been asked to pay in the same as another company, that their members are going to get way more than yours because of the way your rules are written, that wouldn't necessarily seem fair. So there's a lot of challenges to work through with any changes to it, but certainly a lot of people eyeing up that large surplus in the PPF and wondering how can it be used to suit their particular needs or wishes.
So Chris, while David thinks what to do with £12 billion, what's on your mind? Myself laughing my own joke now. What's on your what do you think trustees and employees be thinking about from a risk transfer perspective for this year?
Well, I think those trustees and employers that were thinking about risk transfer before are still thinking about it. And it's more positive than it was if they were thinking about it 12 months ago in terms of the capacity in the market. So that's great news. So I suppose the question is, would there be any change in the number of trustees and employers thinking about risk transfer compared to about a year ago? I suppose the two things that might change it would be the surplus consultation, which might encourage less trustees and employers to think about buyout, and I don't think that would have a significant change. Potentially some of the larger schemes and those that are comfortable with running the risk, the companies running the risk on their balance sheet, would like to consider that and possibly look at getting some of that surplus back. And the other one, as David's alluded to, is the funding code. I would be expecting schemes that have their valuation this year to be surprised and suddenly find out that their buyout position is better than they thought. Even though some of them may have been early 2022 before the interest rates really started to rise, they probably know that if their position has improved significantly. So it would be the additional requirements around that code, the low dependency, the governance, the real sight of how much it's going to cost to run the scheme over the foreseeable future. So it might be that seeing that might push some trustees and employers towards considering buyout sooner to relieve themselves of the risk. So those two points operating in competing directions, neither of them making a significant change because, as David said, the valuations only are discussed as each valuation result is presented. So I would see a steady, probably growth in schemes looking to approach the market as they receive their results and the funding improves.
Yeah, I'd say certainly at the smaller end of the market, you'd expect the pressure to be more towards heading towards buyout rather than, you know, the use of surplus discussions is all well and good, but realistically the thought that a small scheme is going to generate enough surplus not only to cover its ongoing running costs but to be feeding back elements to the employer while still complying with the sort of low risk approach in the new funding regime, I think is probably a bit of a stretch. So realistically you're going to have schemes that are just faced with a ever-growing burden. I know we've focused on actuarial issues, but you know there's a growing governance burden as well. I think, you know, all of that coming, own risk assessments, dashboards, you know, there's all kinds of things, as well as the actuarial work with the new funding code, that are going to suggest that for a small scheme who's now in a pretty good funding place, actually is the end game now in sight, rather than something we're going to be burdened with for the next 40 years. I think there's going to be a lot more schemes heading in Chris's direction.
Yeah. Okay. Time has put up with us, so we'll call it a day there. So thank you, David. Thank you, Chris, for your thoughts on the past year and the future of funding and risk transfer. Thanks very much.